jazz.
Well, is you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Okay. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 152. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
So this is kind of a mix of stuff, not any particular rhyme or reason. We're doing two 2018 releases, review copies that came across the desk, and then a couple of things I picked up on vinyl. I don't think we've focused on... No, we did do Dave Liebman before. We did Lookout Farm.
Yeah, isn't he kind of a blanket fort for you?
I would not think of Liebman as a blanket fort player. I do think that we're going to cover now a second album of his that might be admitted into those sacred precincts, even though really he's more School of Coltrane and is best known for kind of White Hot Blowing.
Right.
But what I find interesting about this album is that he's not necessarily indulging in that, and it's a little different vibe to it. Both, I'd say, of these albums, Pat Martino's and Dave Liebman's, are kind of dealing with the 70s, even though Liebman's album Quest comes out in 1983, Pat Martino's Starbright comes out in 1976. I feel like both of them are kind of reacting and trying to find their way through that really problematic decade for jazz. And then the new albums are Bernie Dresel's Burn, 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 which is a play on Sing, Sing, Sing. B-E-R-N.
But also, it's spelled B-E-R-N.
Right. His name is Bernie. I like a Bernie. And it's a big band album. And then Javon Jackson's For You, which is a quartet album. Javon is a tenor player who was born just a year before I was and is really solidly in the tradition. So I thought maybe we'd begin with the early stuff and then move on to the brand new stuff. Does that sound okay?
Sounds fine to me.
And we're going to try a special approach with Bernie's album. We're going to call it Workshoppin'. So we'll see how that goes. Well, let's just begin with Pat Martino, if that's okay. Starbright from 76. He's an electric guitar player. His story is pretty dramatic because he had an aneurysm in 1980, after which he lost his memory and any ability to play the electric guitar, which he'd been doing since he was very young, and he had to relearn the instrument from scratch. Pat was born in 1944, and his first leader date was released in 1967. So Starbright from 1976 is the album of a veteran, even though he wasn't all that old at the time it came out. And though he was known as a kind of straight ahead player, this is very much not that. So it's the very 70s. What do you think of Starbright?
Who's the personnel on this one, by the way?
It's a group that has got an electric bassist, Will Lee. I believe Will was involved with the Saturday Night Live band later.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
A couple drummers, flute Al Regney, I'm guessing there. Mm-hmm. Pat Martino plays both guitar and synthesizer, Gil Goldstein on keyboards, Michael Maneri and Warren Bernhardt on synthesizer, a tabla player, Marty Quinn, a violinist, Joe Donfrio. So not your typical hard bop blowing date, not an all acoustic ensemble by any stretch. And
no.
Pat offers up everything from fusion to Weather Report style fusion to acoustic guitar playing classical music. So.
Yeah, you know what? This surprised me because I thought we were in for another, you know, the guitarists, the great white guitarists of the 70s, the Jim Halls and the Joe Passes. And sometimes this will sound like sacrilege to guitar aficionados. I sometimes have a hard time keeping them straight. You know, I'm not someone who can, you know, there are certain players I can hear and I know who they are right away. And the guitar players, you know, unless it's Grant Green or Django, you know, I don't pick them up instantly, you know. And so I was expecting, given the date, that this was going to be one of those kind of affairs. Lots of tasteful guitar of a certain style that would be, for me, a kind of indistinguishable mass that wouldn't, you know, connect for me. But I liked this instantly from the very first cut. It's surprising. The first thing I thought of when the opening tune, the title tune starts, is Brian Eno's ambient music.
Wow, because I thought a weather report, and I know you hate it, so I'm surprised it got
Yeah.
off so clean. Okay, cool.
No, because it's sort of got this, he's really into, he's got a good hooky melody. He's got this sort of cascading, rhythmic, repeated figure, very bright, major key thing, and it even sounds like Another Green World to a certain extent, like the way it sits in the headphones. Now, not all the cuts are like that. So we get a fair amount of, synthesizer fusion-y and electric guitar-y wash over which Martino will play his acoustic guitar. And I think it's fantastic. I really enjoyed the hell out of this. I liked the classical pieces. I liked the fusion-y stuff. It never got so fusion-y where I wanted, or I was having a kind of weather report flashback. I could see why someone might feel that way, but I never felt like there were knights coming in out of the mist, getting ready to joust with dragons. It doesn't have that feel to me.
Good.
I only have one other album by Pat Martino, an earlier disc, I believe, called The Maker, which I like, but had never really registered for me. But now I kind of want to go back and pay more attention to him. And if all of his stuff pre-breakdown in the 70s is like this, Yes Please, A Double Helping, I like this a lot. For all the personnel, it's actually kind of sparse, which isn't to say that it doesn't get shreddy at times, right? Because it does have some electric-y, listen to me using really smart jazz vocab words, electric-y. It has moments where you sort of get synthesizers and electric guitar kind of making noise in the background over which, he'll play acoustic. But there are also plenty of just contemplative quiet numbers here. His take on Nefertiti is very, very tender, very gentle, and there's almost nothing else going on there. There's some electric keyboard noodling behind him, but it's just him basically on acoustic. So I ended up liking this quite a bit more than I thought I was going to. I was expecting acoustic guitar, tasteful, indistinguishable mush. I mean, it's not that it is mush, it's that to my ears, it's not a genre that that I can instantly pick out players really quickly and go, oh yes, the graceful stylings of so and so. But yeah, this was just unique and interesting from the get-go. I don't know. It just scratched an itch, or I was in the right place to hear this. It suited me to a T from beginning to end. And most of the cuts are pretty short. I think the longest thing here is about 6.5 minutes. Some of the things here come in under a minute, and I thought that was a really good tactic. None of these pieces, unlike some of the weather report pieces, none of these are bloated. They don't go on and on and on. Which might sound silly, but this week, one of the things I was listening to, we might talk about it in Pop Matters for a moment, was one of the Emerson Lake Palmer discs from
Oh.
Return of the Manticore, which is,
Okay.
and that's the one that I was listening to, the disc that includes Memoirs of an Officer and a Gentleman, which goes on for 20 minutes, and Pirates, which is this really rococo, it's like Pirates of Penzance on acid and steroids at the same time. And their 10-minute version of Fanfare for the Common Man, and to me, that's kind of Weather Report's fault. I blame Weather Report for that. But this doesn't like,
Unfair.
no,
Unfair.
I think
They are
they're
not
responsible.
responsible for ELP.
I think they're responsible for that. But
No.
this isn't like that at all. I really do like this quite a bit. I just think there's even some funk to it. Like, it has a lot of different little moods within it, right? So, like, some of the cuts. Blue Macaw is kind of funky. and he's playing electric there over kind of a repeated groove. I just like this a lot. I don't know. It really sort of appeals to me quite a bit. It makes me want to dig into this particular decade. I don't know what he sounded like after his breakdown, but like I said, if this is what he was up to in the 70s, hell yes. I could do with a lot more of this. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I tend to associate him as a much more straight-ahead player. The one album I had by him before this was Strings, also on vinyl, from 67, so it came out the same year as his debut. And it is, as you described, kind of a straight-ahead post, or not post-bop, but hard-bop guitar album. And yeah, I don't know that it had a real strong fingerprint for me, whereas this album has a lot of charisma, and as you say, a lot of shifting moods. I mean, there are 12 total tracks, and as you say, some of them are under a minute. Only one of them is really over four, the 6.5 minute track. So a lot of different shifting moods. It's kind of, oddly enough, a portfolio album, even though this is an artist who is not just starting out, but has been around on the scene for many years as a sideman and then a leader. So you tend to think of portfolio albums as being the work of young artists who are trying to kind of just show everything they can do. But he's confident enough in his own voice that these don't really just sound like experiments. They kind of all come off pretty well, and there is a kind of overriding, I don't know, it's not really mellow, it's not all a ballad or laid back, but there is kind of a, I don't know, a unifying mood to it. It's mostly on the gentler side, at least sonically. A fair amount of it's introspective, though not all of it. When he does get hardcore fusion and a bit thrashy, it never lasts long enough that it kind of starts to wear on you.
Yeah, Blue Macaw fades out right when he starts to kind of take off. You know, it's like okay, that's enough of that.
And it's Warner Brothers, so, you know, this is kind of a major label product at the time. So, you know, it's got a fair amount of polish. It sounds good. Yeah, I think it's very successful. It's just kind of the album, kind of an album that you put on, and it's not real long, and you're kind of at the end before you know it, and there was no real down points, and you're kind of ready to flip it over and play it again. If you know, it's consistently good. Yeah, I just, it kind of struck me and I liked it. So I thought, well, let's just put it in the rotation here and talk about it a bit. Apparently he did this album and one right after it in this more fusion-y mold, but I don't associate him after his aneurysm. God, maybe I'm sure this train is becoming audible. It just,
yeah, I can hear it.
It's amazing. Well, we have this little spur like three houses north and they're supposed to turn it into a trail. And maybe 5 or 6 more years of negotiation, they can actually fucking do it. But it's rarely used. But, you know, the train is on.
Hey, I have the neighbor's dog. So it's, you know, it's,
oh,
all,
I know, the neighbor's dog.
It's all part of the wonder of.
He is really the third member of this team.
He is.
He's got things to say. Okay, train, you can do it.
I can't really hear it that much now. So yeah, I like the hell out of this. Also, I should mention, since we often talk about pointless appearance matters, he has a really good mustache.
Yeah, well, he's known as a pretty, I don't know, mathematical player for some people. Not that he's into math jazz or math rock, but just somebody, you know, and this is an album of a fair amount of warmth. So anyway, I don't know how much, I think it's somewhat of an anomaly in his catalog, but it's one that I just happened to find in a bin and thought, well, let's give it a try. I don't really have much Pat Martino at all, and it's become a real grower for me.
What's the label this is on again?
Warner Brothers. So okay. Yeah, it was a major label joint.
Nice.
At the time. So anyway, if you see it floating around, I think there's a double CD out of this album and the one that came directly after it, whose name at the moment escapes me. And then, of course, it's out there on vinyl.
And should mention that one of the keyboard players is someone we've done one of his albums before, Mike Maneri. We did an album of his in an earlier podcast. I forget which one, but we have done one of these guys has appeared in a podcast.
Yeah, for the most part, they're not names that kind of leap out to me, but I think all the playing is solid. And he really does it again. He shows a lot of different guitar approaches. It's not all about one sound. So you can hear him kind of in acoustic and electric and even synthesizer.
Thank you.
The next album up is a very, as I said, kind of coming out of the 70s, where do we go next kind of album from Dave Liebman. And it's simply called Quest. This is it's a little confusing because this group releases, one question is it by Liebman or is it by Quest? And that's a little bit up in the air from 1983. And then this group releases other recordings, all of which feature Liebman, but there is shifting personnel. So
mostly it's him and Richie, I don't know how you say his last name, Birach?
Something like that. Yeah, he was known as like the Code or something, this piano player. I actually, on my recent trawl through a couple Indianapolis area record stores, picked up a solo piano performance by him, which he called Hubris.
Nice.
On ECM.
I've got an early ECM with just a duo between Richie and Liebman. I'm saying Richie because I just don't know how to pronounce his last name. Beirach.
Right.
If it's German, you know, then it's Bayrach or Bayrach or Bayrach. I don't know. But I don't know how he pronounces it, so I don't want to offend anyone. But yeah, they work together a lot. I think
right.
He's on most of the Quest albums. And there's Quest Live. There's several of these. But this is the first one, right?
Right. And we've talked before about this difficulty that jazz groups have, is that to be a group in jazz is kind of complicated. You typically don't make enough money as a unit to kind of merge your identity into the group fully. In other words, everybody in the group tends to do a lot of other projects. And also just the nature of the jazz life means that often the personnel is kind of transitory. You might have one or two people stay in the group, but it's not the same people for 5 years, 10 years. So there are exceptions. Weather Report kind of was an early example of a group in jazz that had a brand name. Now, it was really based on two musicians who kind of stayed with it throughout and everybody else rotated, but you know they had a name the way a rock band would. But for the most part, kind of hard for jazz musicians to pull that off rather than just being the Dave Liebman Quartet. It's a little harder to sustain that kind of identity in the jazz marketplace. So this was somebody who'd always been in the trenches back from the late 60s, played with Elvin Jones's group. He was one of the many tenor players who went through that group, played with Miles Davis before that for a couple years.
Apparently he studied at the very beginning with Lenny Tristano, of all people.
Wow.
I know. Is that hard to imagine?
Because, yeah, you don't...
I can't think of a player who is less like Warren Marsh in some ways.
Right, yeah. You know, he's so much... You know, I always think of him as being out of, not shamelessly aping or stuck and mired in, but, you know, originating from the Coltrane school.
Yep.
And Coltrane and Lenny kind of... Wow.
Oil and water.
Yeah, I mean, just think about the kind of drummers John Coltrane liked versus the kind of drummers Lenny liked.
Right.
that Venn diagram, there is no touching at all of the spheres.
I mean, yeah.
They're not even on the same piece of paper.
Not a lot of overlap, but that would make, you know, that would sort of make Liebman the kind of axolotl or whatever. You know, he's the weird vestigial limb that connects these two evolutionary spurs of that. Listen to me mix my metaphors. He's the vestigial limb that connects these two evolutionary limbs on the great tree of jazz.
There you go. The one crossover dude. And yeah, Liebman for me is, there's some stuff of his I really like. There's other stuff that just seems a bit driven, and I'm not sure humorless is quite fair, but just not necessarily as productive as I'd like it to be, at least for me. Not always as nuanced sometimes as I'd like. And this project I kind of was fascinated by because he is, especially in the 70s and early 80s, and, you know, I guess to some degree, I mean, he has an amazing appearance on He Loved Him Madly, this 30-minute slab of music that Miles Davis wrote after Duke Ellington's death. So he's been involved with some atmospheric stuff, not so much when he worked with Elvin Jones. Elvin's not a big guy about drifting clouds of, you know, evocative innuendo. That's not his style. And this, I felt like, was an album that was very much in its own way about creating mood, but was not just aimlessly drifting. I don't know what you thought of it. You know, six performances, 40 minutes. It's a quartet with Richie on keyboards, George Mraz on bass, Al Foster drums, and Al, of course, also had played with Miles. So thoughts about Quest from 1983.
Well, so the first cut is called Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And isn't that penned by somebody else? It's penned by Mraz, or is that penned by, who's that by?
Couple by Liebman.
That one's by
One
Foster.
By Mraz. Is this one by Foster?
Okay. That's by Foster. And there are two covers on the album, Softly as a Morning Sunrise and Lonely Woman. I think the title cut, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, is kind of an interesting choice here because the album kind of goes back and forth between these two modes. I think the covers kind of, you know, tell the tale for me, right? So he takes Softly as in a Morning Sunrise on soprano, and he takes it fucking fast. And you can really hear the Coltrane influence there on soprano. You know, there's a couple of schools of soprano playing, modern soprano playing, right? There's kind of the Steve Lacy monk-derived school, and there's the Coltrane school, and Liebman is squarely in the Coltrane school. I mean, there's no squonks, there's no astringency, there's nothing mathy about this. You know, it's very spirited and energetic, and they take that song at a ridiculous clip. It is really fast, and I enjoy that particular interpretation, and you know, it could be Coltrane. If Al Foster had a little more, if he had a little more Elvin Jones in his butt, you know, this could be a Coltrane song. To me, then, the other interesting cut would be Lonely Woman, the Ornette Coleman cover. Which is as moody and as atmospheric and as sparse and spare as Softly as in a Morning Sunrise is busy and frenetic. I mean, it's, and is he's playing what, flute there? Alto flute?
Well, alto flute, yeah. I like that performance. It's pretty good.
I do too. And I actually had to go back and listen to the Coleman tune to get the melody in my head again, because I just couldn't hear the melody when I listened to this. It was taken at such a slow, spare pace, and I was like, I don't quite remember how Lonely Woman goes. I had to listen to it again. And yeah, it's very evocative, very moody and misty, and that's kind of how this album goes, right? You have moody pieces, and then you have brisk, almost burners. Napanock, whatever that is a burner. You got Wisteria, this much sort of slower, evocative number. So yeah, it's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde on the whole album. Maybe the thing I like the best about the album is it sounds great. This is a vinyl dub or vinyl whatever.
Yeah.
My God, you can hear the bass on this. I didn't even have to get out the big boy headphones. I just was like, wow, this is really plummy and really up in the mix, which I really like. I think that really benefits the whole recording. And sometimes it feels like on recordings, the bass is an afterthought, but not here. So yeah, I like this quite a bit. For me, the standouts, I really like Wisteria. I think that's a really terrific cut. Lonely Woman, like I said, I can't hear the Ornette melody, but it's really moody and evocative. I really like that. And I thought Softly as in a Morning Sunrise is terrific. I really like that take on the song. So, yeah, overall, I like this. You know, I tend to have a short tether for soprano. Maybe it's because I've got one of those scratching the 70s Steve Lacy discs in the rotation at the moment. You know,
oh, no.
Their songs on there are called things like clicks, you know, and it sounds like he's trying to snap the keys off the instrument and calling it a song. And so when you hear someone play soprano as evocatively, but also as briskly as Lieb does here, it's kind of a pleasure. Remind me, you said, I think, already, but what's the label for this?
Yeah, the label on this album, it's not a major one. I found this and another Liebman album called Doing It Again when I was out record shopping.
It's not on, as far as I know, I can't find it on AllMusic, and usually they'll mention the label, but I don't see it there. That's why I was wondering. I was just curious.
Let's pull it up here. God, Trio Records, licensed from Trio Kenwood Corporation. Yeah, this may have come out first in Japan. And then it comes out here on, there's other, I think it came out of the U.S. It comes out, it says in Denmark on Storyville, but I think I got a, I'd have to go down and pull it out. I don't know.
I was just curious because AllMusic has it listed as 91, and we both know that's actually wrong. So
yeah, I guess reissued, it kind of floats. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's got a kind of a long life where it keeps kind of popping up in another edition years later. It's not something that came out once definitively.
Right.
But yeah, it's good sounding recording. And to me, you know, for six songs, every one of them to me has at least one melodic watermark or hook and an idea behind it and a mood. And so none of it seems like make weight, or none of it's just kind of by the numbers. And so the album has a pretty clear identity from beginning to end for me. And that, I think, is often, you know, we've got what is a pretty traditional, you know, it's a jazz quartet. You know, this is not reinventing the wheel. The players are all very, very fine, but there are literally thousands and thousands of sessions like this, roughly speaking, six songs, four or five musicians. So what distinguishes the really good ones from the just solid ones? And I think one of it's just good programming where, you know, there isn't a song there that just seems like a make-weight blues or just yet another standard they had nothing new to say about. You know, it's all kind of memorable. And the originals, I think, are interesting frameworks for improvisation. You know, they're not necessarily deathless melodies, but they generate good music. They're not just dead ends or just barely adequate launching pads to get to the solos. So I think it's, you know, really successful throughout. I actually kind of like doing it again, but that's from 83 and John Scofield's on it. And it's just a little bit sleazier, although, I mean, given the title, you would expect it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a shot of him with his saxophone in a case and one of these really weird angles with this huge building and I assume New York looming over him. And there is a sense, you know, just calling your album that it's like, here's another session. I mean, it's actually, I think, pretty good. But of the two of them, I felt like this was a bit stronger. It also helped this one has six songs instead of just four. And I know you have mixed feelings about early Scofield. So I thought of the two, both of which I was pretty happy with. I'd go with this one. And I, you know, recommend it because, again, Liebman for me is a hard figure to pin down. He's done a lot of different things. He's not like a Grant Green where you kind of know what you're going to get, and it might be Grant on a good day or Grant on a medium day, but the feel of the session is you've got a pretty good sense. You know, he's not one Mr. or Horace Silver, whoever, you know, a super consistent person that is kind of reliable. He's more like, well, he might be doing something over here. He might have a big band. He might have a Coltrane tribute. He might be in a mood where it's just like steel the whole time and it's kind of exhausting. Or he might be in a mood where he's here, I feel like, more flexible, introspective. He's got more colors to his palette and he's a lot more engaging. But I like this one. So, you know, another one. I'm glad you liked it. I wasn't sure what you think of this. I wasn't sure what you think of the Pat Martino, because I said the first track on that one reminded me of Weather Report, and I know that's kind of, you need a safe word to talk about Weather Report with Mike. You know,
it's only because you made us talk about too many that one time. Yeah, no, I dug both of these, and for me, Liebman can be a problematic figure just because my first listen to him was, you know, a duo date with Richie.
Ah.
And that was really thorny and difficult. And so, of course, I went out and got, I think they have a second date called probably Chant 2 or something like that. I forget. And, you know, I was just like, hard, difficult. But I kind of like it more in the Coltrane mode that he gets into on several of the songs here.
He got a couple back in the day, and they've stopped doing this for whatever reason. Mosaic, the record reissue company, put out, instead of box sets, what they called selects, which tend to be three CD sets of music. And they did one of him with Randy Brecker quintet. And I think Richie was in that as well. And it's just kind of live stuff. And one disc of it had been released as an album. And I think the other two were other sessions. And it's like, you know, they'll play a standard for 15 or 20 minutes.
Mm.
And it's good, but kind of exhausting.
That's too much Coltrane for you.
Yeah, just a lot. Well, and it's just kind of, you know, a good post-bop quintet playing standards and, you know, whatever at great length in a live setting. And it's like, well, that there has to be a lot of magic in the air for that to sustain my interest over 3 hours. Otherwise, it can get a little bit rote. And then I think they also did a set of him with Barack, or however you say his name, Barack Obama, Richie Barack Obama, I think is his full name. And that was, I assume, all duets. And I've not heard that one, and I'm sure it's OOP2 now. So he clearly, I mean, there was a long-standing collaboration between these guys. I was assuming that the solo album Hubris by The Pianist would be a little thornier than it turned out to be. It's not quite Windham Hill. I wouldn't accuse it of that, but it skirts it a couple of times, and it's fairly accessible, mellow solo piano recital. Picked that one up in fairly pristine vinyl. It was like a DJ copy on my last excursion, and it's fine, but it's not. I was hoping it was going to be a little bit more interesting than it turned out to be. So another player that I don't know a lot about, other than he played a lot with Liebman.
Yeah.
All right, well, are we ready to move on to 2018?
Sure.
Javon Jackson's release on Solid Jackson Records, I think he, in short, he's gone indie, called For You. And there's a beautiful flower on the front.
And you can't find any information about this on the internet.
Well, the reason, my dude, is that it comes out in November. So it doesn't exist yet.
So tell me personnel and
Yeah, let
stuff.
me pull that up. His promo guy was very kind and gave the information on that. So it's a quartet with Jeremy Manasseh on piano, David Williams on bass, and McClenty Hunter on drums. And that's a great name. McClenty Hunter sounds like, I don't know, like an extra in some kind of action movie, and I like it. So this, let's see, when does this pop? November 9th. But yeah, there's nothing out about it right now. He is, as I said, he's 53. It says it's his 20th release as a leader. Javon was in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, pretty much the final edition. I think he was there right up to Blakey's death. And apparently he went through a period of kind of more funk saxophone
Yeah.
playing, and then he came back to the hard bop gospel. And I gotta say, I've been aware of this guy. I mean, it's a name I know, but I don't have any Jackson in my collection other than this. Did you ever pick up any
Nope.
Javon before now?
No, I've not. This is the only album by him that I have at this point. And if his whole discography was like this, I guess I would kind of like to dig deeper into it. I'm not sure. It might be interesting to start with the Jazz Messenger stuff that he was on and then dip my toe into the funk stuff, because it sounds like this is a kind of a new turn for him in his career, this stuff, which I'm just going to go out and say I like this quite a bit. And it's not that I don't like funk. I'm always a little cautious and nervous when a jazz player goes to another genre as a move, right? When, Ambroise Acamusere goes to rap or whatever, or not, he's not actually, Robert Glasper's a better example.
Very
You
good.
know, I go, makes me a little nervous. So yeah, I would dip my toe gingerly into the earlier stuff. I'd like to hear the Art Blakey stuff, and then I just kind of see what looked interesting.
Yeah, and I think the funk was not, I mean, I don't think he did nothing but funk after he went solo. I think it was a interval, I believe, from what I've read.
Yeah. Well, he too, he's on the Coltrane tree, and that's an influence here. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a fine influence. I don't mind that at all. I think that's probably a good thing in this context. I thought this album was pretty good. I hope you liked it.
Yeah, well, and as you say, I mean, when we say Coltrane, it's not that he is necessarily molding his solos slavishly like that,
Yeah.
but a couple of the songs he does are literally the feel of the great quartet.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
The drumming, the arrangement, the vibe.
Thank you.
definitely, and I'm sure quite self-awarely.
I'm sure it's deliberate. Now, some of them aren't. Like Backstage Sally doesn't sound like Coltrane at all. You know, it's its own thing. And even the...
And I just looked up, you know who wrote Backstage Sally?
No, who?
Wayne Shorter, apparently, for...
Wow.
The song, I've never heard it by Wayne. My God, his catalog is deep. And he wrote it for the Messengers. It just, that's a name I would never... If you asked me who wrote a song called Backstage Sally, that's not who I...
And it's doesn't... Well, I don't know Shorter's compositions the way you do, but it feels like a kind of very straightforward romp. I like it. I thought it's a pretty cool number, but it didn't have any Coltrane-y feel to it. There are some songs that do. My Man Hubbard has some of that. Some of it's the piano player. Some of the blocky comping behind him reminds me of McCoy. The drumming isn't as insistent. No one's as insistent as Elvin, but yeah, there are definitely some songs here where I was like, hey, that sounds like kind of familiar. And I like what you said. It's more in the... it's more the ensemble as a whole. Now, the whole album isn't like that at all, right? So, like, Native Son, who wrote that song, by the way? Do you have that?
Well, let me see here. It depends on the press kit. It says, okay, Williams' groove happy Native Son. So, apparently, that would be by the bass player.
Cool.
David Williams.
It has a kind of bossa Latin feel. So, I mean, this is someone who has some Coltrane influence, but it's not, he's not in a particular bag. He's not like, let's do Coltrane. He has an album from just a few years ago called Celebrating John Coltrane. So he definitely has that. And apparently early in his career, he played with Elvin. So he's got that. I think his first solo date, Elvin played drums. So, and it was called Me and Mr. Jones.
Yes, there you go.
I mean, so he definitely has that influence. But yeah, this isn't slavish by any means. I thought Native Son was a pretty cool cut, the kind of Latin feel. So I kind of enjoyed that. It's not that he lays out, but there's room for other people. Did the pianist write Holy Land? Who wrote Holy Land?
Okay,
I'm sorry. I keep asking this question.
But... No, that's fine. It's you don't have the press release. I should have forwarded it to
no,
you.
No, I think you did. I just always delete them. Sorry.
I'm so glad to be helpful here. Walton, Swinging Anthem, Holy Land. So... That would be a guy named Walton. I don't know. Okay. He's not in the group.
That's Cedar Walton.
Probably so.
Interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a feature for the bass player and the pianist. So even though this is Jackson's date, there's room here. Yeah, that piece in particular really gives the bass player a lot of room to maneuver. And it's solid. I like it. This is one of those discs. I have the same problem. I got to tell you, I have the same problem with Osby. And, you know, we did that podcast a while back, you know, Osby and Garrett and Coleman, a lot of the modern players, it takes me a while, modern horn players, it takes me a while to grok them, right? So, you know, Redman, I'm kind of there. Steve Coleman, kind of there. Garrett, still getting there. I know that you're a big Osby fan and I'm not quite there with Osby.
And he's a much more cerebral, as is Coleman.
Yes, yes.
Than Jackson. I mean, he is, I think of Jackson as a much more solidly mainstream
yes.
player.
And I like this. I like this plenty. So, yeah, I want to know more about him, and I want to go deeper into the catalog and cautiously look at some of the funk stuff. And just because I have listened to some funk jazz, and it just... It starts to sound the same. Maybe I've listened to too much Richard Groove Holmes or something. It gets on my nerves after a while. I have a feeling, though, that Jackson's take would never be based on just this album. I kind of have a nice feeling about him. I think I'd like to look at some other stuff by him and see where he goes, what he gets up to, because it's pretty good. And I like the band. I don't know how you felt about the band, but I like the piano player. He doesn't just do McCoy Tyner comps. Like he's good. He's got his own thing. And when he gets room to stretch, he has some really nice solos. And I like the bass player here quite a bit too. The drummer didn't quite register for me. Usually I pay a lot of attention to that. It's not that he's bad. It's just he wasn't in the forefront in my ears as much as the other two players in Jackson.
Yeah.
And Jackson also has... Did it seem to you that he's got a little bit of... he's got just a little bit of the Panther in him. There's a little bit of quoting. Not a lot.
A Dexter in him.
A little Dexter. He's got a little... He drops some quotes in. He's not the kind of loping, genial, quipster that Dexter Gordon is, but he'll, you know, he slips in a couple of, it's not even like, Dexter will quote a whole line from a song, you know, take me out to the ball game or something, you know, but you hear a few notes from Jackson from time to time, and I'm like, yeah, cute, you know, he never takes it overboard. It felt a little Dexter to me. I kind of like that.
I'd say the envelope of his note attacks is a little softer.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a Gonzalez figure, but he is a little bit leaning that way, where he is not as definitive an articulator as some players. And I'd say technically, you know, the important thing about him is he's musical and expressive. I like him as a player. You know, I don't think I listen to him and think, my God, this guy's technique is just pristine and unbelievable and super fast. I mean, he might be able to play that way, but that doesn't seem to be his focus. You know, he's not somebody who's trying to blow you away with just 30-second note runs.
No Skronk here, no multiphonics, none of that.
Right, and no just super fast, hyper-technical, I'm the baddest executant on the block kind of stuff. So what I find interesting about the record is that it's, you could call it jazz, the jazz album. I mean, in some ways, it just seems so absolutely squarely in the jazz tradition of kind of small group music from Blue Note forward. And the way it's engineered, you can tell it's in the fact there aren't quite enough minor tunes. You know, it's not a Blue Note session, but it's not miles away from that template set up in the late 50s. But, and I don't know that Jackson as a player is, he's not just a technical monster. I mean, he's obviously a professional saxophone player. He's an amazing musician, but he's not in that category, the most intimidating of all the players I've heard. And yet somehow the record just hangs together well. It always seems sincere. It attempts to kind of evoke these moods that we remember from classic jazz albums of the past, and I think succeeds rather than just sounding like a pale imitation. You know, he's got the feel for what he's doing, and he can inhabit that mode authentically rather than trying to recreate something he doesn't quite get the core of, which, you know, some albums you'll hear are trying to be Blue Note circa 1964, and they just don't know quite how to bring it off. So yeah, I just found this record, you know, if I bore down into it analytically, I'd be hard pressed to argue why it's a special effort or it's better than so many albums in this idiom for the last 50 years. But I do think it's well above average because of just the feel of it and the earnestness and the moods it creates. I think it's very effective. I don't think he's got anything in particular to say other than I'm really good at playing mainstream jazz. I mean, this album doesn't seem to have an agenda. It's not about Cedar Walton, as you're asking, composed Holy Land as well as Simple Pleasure. And I guess he was a mentor for Jackson. So Jackson's kind of probably one of the last musicians with his roots with people like Blakey and Walton, who kind of are part of that lineage of the great hard bop players.
He went to the school.
He was there and he did it in person rather than learning it purely in class, as it were.
Yeah.
But, you know, it grew on me. And as I said, if I listened to just a note by note kind of analysis of it, I'd say, well, there's nothing real super outstanding here. But then if I just listen to it as music, as communication, as a record, well, that was pretty good. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear other stuff by him. You know, it's kind of like my growing appreciation for Stanley Turrentine. It's not that Turrentine is doing something that many of his peers cannot do or outdo at the time. It's just he does it with a kind of personality and authenticness and grit that, you know, ultimately holds up really well in his best stuff. So, and I think in a way, the more time you get away from that, the more appreciation you have, because you're not looking for the next innovator. You're just saying, here's a musician that was happy in the idiom he found and productive in it. the last piece, I thought we'd try something a little different and talk about the album kind of both as a work, you know, our typical critical way, just, you know, did we like it? Did it work for us? But then also think a little bit about it as a workshop. This is not a young artist. Bernie has been around, but he is a relatively new leader as a recording artist. He's released two albums, a live album. This is his second. It's called Burn, 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 which is a follow-up to Live and Burnin' from 2016. With a name like Burn, you know, he's got puns for the rest of his life. It's on the Digit label and all available on Pure Audio Blu-ray disc. Interesting. Which I will talk about the sound of it in a minute, I guess. So this guy apparently played with Gordon Goodwin's Big Fat Band, which a lot of big band aficionados are really high on. I've never really listened to much of Mr. Goodwin's work. Played with Brian Setzer. We all, yes, both of us of a certain age, remember Brian.
Straight cat strut.
And he's a studio cat. He's been on such shows as The Family Guy and The Simpsons and played live with Sinatra, James Brown, Chaka Khan, Brian Wilson, James Taylor, and Patti LaBelle. So studio cat who's, I guess, got enough of a war chest to kind of fund his own big band now and get some arrangements released. So just initial thoughts, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about like strong points, and then if you're going to say, Bernie, come sit down with us, we don't know anything, we're just a couple of stupid bastards, but if you wanted to listen to us, what would we suggest for your third project? What could you work on? What should you keep?
Huh.
So thoughts about Burn, Burn, Burn.
Interesting. I think we're going to have a little disconnect or difference here. So here's my feeling about this. So this is a big band project, and Bernie's got some, he's got some fingers on the knobs in the control booth, right? There's some twiddling going on. There's some electronica added to some of the mix here, right? Not every song.
A little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit. I don't know. I feel like this is just the latest in the kind of... We've had a bunch of big band review albums, big band albums come flying across the desk lately for review. Is that just like a thing now? I mean, everyone's got a big band project?
You know, I don't know. Partially, it's in terms of review copies, I think that there's so little oxygen for, I think, big bands being quote-unquote taken seriously by jazz enthusiasts and the jazz press. So, you know, you've got Maria Schneider, you've got Darcy James Argue's band for the hipsters, and I feel like, you know, his project is, financially speaking, held together with sticky tape. And then... really, I don't know. Who are the other important big bands that get a lot of press coverage?
Yeah, I don't know about important. It just seems like...
But yeah, there are... Then I guess my point is that you have these kind of musicians who are, you know, not necessarily super well-known, high-profile, who are trying to get their projects together and put out. Yeah, you know, and we get the review copies.
Yeah, so here's my feeling. In general, I liked it. There was nothing that I disliked. I didn't hear anything and go, oh, shit, not this, right? Nothing struck me here in a negative way. I didn't dislike anything. I will say that, you know, with all the big band music that seems to be floating across our desks lately, I had a hard time distinguishing this. It's not that all big bands sound the same. They don't. But generally, if you're going to have a big band, you've got a bunch of guys who have cut their teeth in the studio who are all studio aces. So they're all really good. So the level of professionalism you can expect on these albums is usually extremely high. These guys all can play this stuff. So it's not a question of, it's not really a question of professionalism. It's like, what is it about the arrangements that's going to stand out? What is it about the arrangements that's going to, like, you know, hook me in? And I have to say, I like this. I like it plenty. But it's rare that when this is in the rotation, I go, oh, I gotta stop it. I gotta hear that again. I don't know who the trumpeter is, but they've got a really talented or a couple of really talented trumpeters here, and they seem to monkey with the dial a few times during some of the trumpet solos. You get the echo chamber turned up a little bit, which is distinct. That's like a distinguishing thing, especially if it happens on Sweet Beat. For me, I think I can test an arrangement or test my feeling about an arrangement on a standard. You know, when you hear a standard, you go, okay, what's this guy's difference? I kind of dug his arrangement of A Night in Tunisia. I kind of dug his arrangement of It's All Right With Me. Even though I've got Sammy Davis Jr.'s live version of It's All Right With Me, which is enough to just, you know, blow the roof off any dump. I mean, there's just nothing like it. I mean, he's... But when you've heard Sammy Davis Jr.'s live version, it's like, no one ever should do this song again. He just destroys it. He's just, you know, it's a phenomenal version. But I like this version. I think it's very nice. It's tasteful. It's good. The Sammy Davis Jr. version that I've been listening to, I forget who his arranger is. Someone named Marty something. It's just, when he finishes, like, you hear the audience are just all sopping wet. You know, they're just like, oh my God. You know, he's, you know, it's one of those kind of things. So, yeah, on the covers, I thought that the arrangements were interesting without being especially distinctive. It seems like he takes the most pleasure in writing for the horns rather than the woodwinds.
Well, and let me just so you're aware of this, and I had not realized it until I looked at the press materials. This is not Bernie as a arranger. I kind of assumed, like you,
yeah,
that this project would be about him as a arranger. The project's really about him as drummer and possibly producer.
Hmm.
But a lot of different members of the band
interesting.
Contribute arrangements. And I think that is, to me, the key to the things I want to say about this record. So it says, arrangements and or compositions of Andrew New, Bill Cunliffe, Scott Healy, Nan Schwartz, Michael B. Nelson, and Greg Adams. So it's like one of those comedy movies that the script was written by
right.
seven different
yeah,
people.
Yeah. So that makes it hard to get like a real feel on the whole album. I was going to single out his drumming as... He's definitely in charge. Like, this band has this herd has a shepherd. Let's put it that way. Right? This flock has a shepherd, and he's moving things along. He's definitely he's not quite Art Blakey back there, but he's definitely like, you know, all right. There's an agenda, and he's driving it. Without, I don't think he's an intrusive, or I don't feel like he steps on other people's lines or anything. It's just, this is a driven project, and he is the driver. It's clear on every number that he's the driver.
Well, it's mixed, right? I mean, you really, it's mixed in a way that the drums are kind of right
yes.
up front. And sometimes even when he's just doing simple ting-ting-a-ting accompaniment, that ting-ting-a-ting is like in the first layer of the mix. So you can't miss it.
Yeah. I would say that even the arrangements on slower stuff are all pretty sprightly. So the arrangement of Body and Soul, I mean, I guess it's going to have to be for a big band. Well, it's not true. It doesn't have to be sprightly for a big band, but it is a sprightly arrangement.
And that's an alto feature, and the alto player's tart enough that I think that helps. He's a little, not like Art Pepper. He's not imitating
no.
Art Pepper, but there's that sense of that kind of edge to his playing, and it keeps it from getting too sentimental.
Yeah, so, you know, my general feeling is I like this. Nothing quite registered for me as something where I go, oh my God, that I got to play that for someone. I liked it. It was pleasant. It was good. All these guys are good players. The arrangements felt very brass oriented to me, as opposed to, you don't really, it doesn't feel like it's arranged much to foreground the saxophones at all. And that's fine. That's a choice. As a result, it comes off sounding very brassy and bright to me.
Yeah, there's a couple places where they feature the woodwinds, and I guess this guy's wife is a clarinetist, but yeah, overall, and again,
You got something to say, so say something, because I don't really have strong feelings for or against, but it sounds like you have some issues, so let's hear it.
Well, I guess this album particularly, I was a little surprised because I wondered if I'd be hearing from you one thing I really noticed about the mix, which is, unlike that Deathless Queen song, it doesn't have a big bottom.
No, none.
Yeah, and I don't know whether this is a choice of the engineer or the arranger, but the opposite. I just remember my thighs vibrating pleasurably when Darcy James Argue's unit was there, as well as his big band. In Chicago, and my God, just the bass sax, or the baritone saxophone, sometimes there's a bass clarinet, the bass trombone, and that just rock-solid foundation that was kind of vibrating the house. And how much fun that is. Not the case on this album. I feel like the mix is a little thin and a little top heavy. Sometimes I felt like the brass, as good as they were kind of almost in a separate room, like they've been tamed, or, and I don't know engineering, I can't tell you if something has been quote unquote compressed or not, but it did seem to me like some of the kind of excitement of the playing was lost by the mix. It did benefit from being turned up. This was an album that I think you really had to kind of play loud to work, but it's very difficult, right? To record a big band, it is one of the most dynamically challenging ensembles because these instruments can really swing dynamics, and especially the trumpets, in a very violent way. I mean, the distance between pianissimo and fortissimo is pretty extreme. They can turn on a dime, and there's a lot of different volumes and voices going on, so to capture that is tricky. And I don't know that as a sonic document, I would suggest if, you know, for the third round, I'd like someone else to have a hand in recording it or mixing it or engineering it and try to get something a little more vivid. Because I know that Big Fat Band, I believe, is kind of one of these groups that audiophiles of no one else are really into for the, you know, some audiophile test records are big band records because they get so excited about, you know, dynamic swings, which is not really my bag or my lifestyle, but whatever. I didn't feel like this album did that great. And it was very, very long. This is a really long record. And for me, especially with someone you're trying to get to know that is not an established main, you know, if Chick Corea wants to drop another quadruple or triple release, or Keith Jarrett does, at this point we know what we're in for. We either pick that up or run screaming. But that, and I hate to use this term, but that brand is established enough that people know, okay, yeah, I love Keith Jarrett, I want 3 hours of him. When I don't know that Bernie is that well known to the general jazz public, maybe start smaller and more focused. I would say, you know, 40 minutes of really good stuff is a more effective end to your listeners' interests than almost 2 hours of a mixed bag. And my feeling were is that the songs that interested me the most were the ones that were not the standards. And I really didn't understand why they were playing the standards. I mean, they're great songs, but this group that also plays The World is a Ghetto, and I really liked New Del Inn. I don't know whether that's just an actual end that they're into. Is there some kind of pun in New Delhi? But there's a couple songs that had almost rock or funk feelings. The electric guitar would come screaming in. And there's a high level of energy in Burn, 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 which of course is kind of a comic recasting of Sing, Sing, Sing. And I felt like, well, that could be the band's fingerprint, right? They're a little bit wacky, maybe not quite Zappa levels, but they're willing to be a little puckish, a little tongue-in-cheek. They're willing to bring high energy to the mix. And boy, the arranging on a couple of the originals, I just thought was so much more compelling and interesting and driving, musically speaking, as well as rhythmically. And then the arrangement for so many of the standards just seemed very out-of-the-box generic. I mean, again, competent, but there was nothing memorable about it, and I didn't feel like a band identity was formed by it. And because there's so many of them, it's hard to get a fix on this record because it's so goddamn long. And I think the ears get tired, and there are stretches there where two or three performances in a row are just kind of good, solid, generic big band. I think that's not good. So I guess for me, if I was sitting down with this guy who's probably older than I am and God knows a lot better paid and a lot better musician than I'll ever be, and saying as a listener what I'd like from album 3, half as long, focus on the originals, and maybe covers of 70s stuff, just stuff that is distinctive. This group, these arrangers, don't have anything new to say about the Great American Songbook that I can detect. And try to create a unit that's got kind of a musical identity rather than we've got a really good drummer and we can play a lot of different kinds of music confidently. But I don't think at the end of this, you know what their sound world is. You know, you don't know what their musical values are, what they're going to pin their mast on and say, we stand for this, this, and this. So, yeah, that'd be kind of my take on it. And I'd say, please get a different engineer or, I don't know, give the Barry and the bass some. It just seemed like a kind of a top-heavy mix. Anyway, thoughts about Burn, Burn, Burn. Boom, boom, ba-doom, boom. Any other thoughts, my friend, before we go on to that segment we know is Pop Matters?
Nope. Got none.
Okay. And Mike was real encouraging at the beginning of the show before we started recording. He said, I'm going to suck. So that's always a hopeful sign. Ask for nothing, receive nothing. Okay. I'll
You're a
try to.
big crybaby.
Yes, sir. I'll do my best, sir. All right. Well, any pop matters on your mind, dude?
Sure. I've been lonely and blue. Maybe I've been missing someone like you. But I was only trying to be your friend. Don't get a weird on me, babe. Swear I never try to mix things up again. Don't get a weird on me. Been listening to a couple of things. I already mentioned those idiots, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Don't need to say any more about them.
Did you lose a bet or something?
No, it just came up in the rotation. It's just how it is. You know, it's just how it goes, dude. Sometimes in my little sound, in my little phonic roulette that I engage in, good things happen, and sometimes bad things happen. That was a bad thing.
The worm turned in an unfortunate way.
I was listening to one of the four discs set by Lloyd Cole, known as Cleaning Out the Ashtrays, which are a bunch of remixes of a variety of different songs, which I have to say, it's good. I like the remixes of Lloyd Cole songs. I think it's a good idea. And there are some other songs that are not remixes. They're just originals that didn't make it onto an album hither or yon. And I have a huge Lloyd Cole fixation. He's one of my favorites. So I would be a completist if I could. I think I dig him. I dig him a lot. So
you've got to be close. I mean, there can't be that much.
No, I think he started recording again. So I'm not caught up. There's new stuff available, which I do not have. So there's that.
Huh.
But there are two other things, both of which I will recommend to you if you don't have them. One you won't care about, and the other you should own and listen to. One is Texas Tornadoes, a conjunto, a Tejano, a Norteño supergroup, with Flaco Jimenez on accordion, Freddie Fender before the next teardrop falls, and then Doug Somm and Augie Myers. I think two or three of them are now dead. But Doug Somm and Augie Myers were in Sir Lord Baltimore, you know, an early important rock thing. These are all Texas, North Mexico dudes, and they got together and made they became a Norteño supergroup, and they made a terrific album. They call themselves the Texas Tornadoes. And
cool.
And their album is called Four Aces. it's just fantastic. It's, you know, they sing half in Spanish, half in English. And it's just good. It's just really good. The title song, Four Aces, is just brilliant. It's really funny. And these are like four late middle-aged dudes who've drunk too much beer getting together and making a killer album. And they've got some horn arrangements on here that are just fucking dynamite. So it may not be your thing, but I've got two albums by them, and I think they're fantastic. And I hadn't heard this in a long time, and I popped it in again recently, and I just was reminded again how fucking brilliant they are. And like I said, I think at least one of them, Freddie Fender is dead, and I think one of the other guys is dead, and maybe three out of the four are gone. My God, this was an inspired piece of music. And then the other thing, I don't know how you feel about Stephen Merritt, but Stephen Merritt, in my view, is the 21st century Cole Porter. He has a way with a fucking lyric. So anyway, I've got this album by him, the artwork of which is brilliant, called Show Tunes. And it sounds very much like Stephen Merritt got very high or very drunk after listening to a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan and made up like his own little show. And these are like songs from an opera or operetta that no one will ever see. And he's got a verbal facility that is fucking brilliant. He's like Noel Coward or Cole Porter. I mean, he's just,
well, I mean, I like the dandy.
Dandy Warhol. No, not him.
The Gothic Archies.
But he's in a whole bunch of...
Yeah, well, on the Magnetic Fields, I've got 69 love songs, and if he'd done maybe 22 of them, I mean, there's some amazing stuff on there, and some that's just awfully slight.
But that's the whole point. This is light music. He's doing I mean, you know, he's Ivor Novello reborn. He's doing turn of the century, light, frothy music with just, you know, he loves internal and he loves end rhyme and he loves feminine rhyme. And he's just a wordsmith. He's so, I mean, he's not a good singer. And that's why he often gets people to sing the damn things for him. But my God, he is beyond clever. I just, they're a delight. These songs are absolutely fantastic. I think the world of him. So I was listening to this again and I thought, if you don't have show tunes, you should get it. If it's him on the cover, it looks like someone in kabuki dress, but
okay.
His face is painted and he's wearing a giant headdress. So you can actually recognize him. You can't recognize the human here. So he's just totally, like I said, he got high or drunk listening to Gilbert and Sullivan and said, you know what? I can do that. And so he did. Like, who does that? I don't know. No one. No one does that. But he did it.
Yeah, I think I dimly remember hearing about that record when it came out. Yeah, he's one of these guys with an amazing facility. And I'll always, the Gothic Archies will always be very dear to my heart. I mean, those are great, great songs. And Rand enjoyed him. He read much, though not all, of the series of unfortunate events on which their most developed record is based.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's an amazing talent. I mean, he's one of these guys that I feel like it's somewhat about his ability to create songs rather than his need to express himself. And
that's
so sometimes
exactly right.
Some of his output gets a bit tiring. You know, it's just like, well, okay, this is ingenious.
Well, can you imagine an evening with
Cole
Porter? I mean, you want to blow your brains out. I mean, you can only listen to Night and Day and You're the Top 75 times before you need to kill yourself. These are people who you drink a few martinis and then you go to another room to have a conversation.
Right. But you know, Porter, you could say that in his best stuff, there is something simmering that's genuine there. I mean, as a repressed homosexual I've always thought the Love for Sale, you know, it's like, it's both very witty and it's also, you know, kind of dark.
Sure.
You know, it really there is something real and disturbing about it. And of course, Miss Otis Regrets is unforgettable. And it's not that Merritt never does that. It's just that Merritt is so incredibly prolific that you have to dig more to get the gems out. And of course, there hasn't been a century of sifting out the best from the rest,
right,
the way Porter's enjoy.
Like I said, I think he's light entertainment. I think he knows he's light entertainment. He's not aspiring to tell you about his deep feeling states. Although, if you can,
no.
If you listen to some of the lyrics, there, you know, you can hear where it's coming from. But yeah, he's Noel Coward reborn. You know, he's just, he's as deep as a puddle and as broad as an ocean, and his verbal facility is just, Sting would sell his soul to do some of the things Stephen Merritt does.
Oh God, too late.
Too late. Oh, and by the way, speaking of Sting, I was rooting around on the internet and I found, and I should find it and send it to you, someone pretty smart. He likes to compare cover versions, so he's got kind of a blog. So he compared the Kurt Elling to the Sting version. And he's pretty smart, and he's pretty funny, and he basically explains why the Kurt Elling version is light years better than the original record. Practical Arrangement.
Oh, okay.
So he sort of explains why it's so much better, and it has everything to do with, you know, Sting's ego. I mean, if you look at Sting, and you hear him sing the song, like, his voice is a fraction at this point of what Elling's voice is, but you never believe for a second, as Sting sings the song, that he is actually a guy trying to come to some sort of bargain with a woman. He's going to give her everything. She doesn't have to give him anything, and maybe she'll learn to love him in time. Like, you always believe that he's actually trying to trick her, right? And he's Sting, right? Whereas, you know, where Elling's version is like, you believe that this guy's just fucking sold out. Like, he's like, I'll do anything. Elling just sells out on that song. He sells out brilliantly without using a lot of his pyrotechnics that he can get up to. He just invests the song with all the emotional urgency it can have. But it's a very controlled performance. And you believe that guy is like, it's a bargain. I'll give you everything. Maybe you might love me someday. You just believe him. You know, it's like, you don't believe Sting for a minute. You know, when he says, you know, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm not that clever. And you're like, yes, you think you are.
But I did when he was wearing that diaper in Dune. I was completely convinced at that point that he was earnest. Yeah, I picked up, God, back in maybe, doesn't matter where. I got a cheap vinyl copy of Zenyatta Mendata, or however you say it. It's like the third album. And what struck me as I listened to it for the first time in Probably years, maybe the second time in a few years, is I still remember little details from it. I only ever had it on cassette as a kid. I don't think I listened to it that much, but I guess at that age you retain more of what you hear. And so songs that weren't like a greatest hit or whatever, or little, instrumental details, I'm like, yep, wow, why does my brain have room to remember that? It's not a bad record, but just it was striking to me that I didn't feel like that was a central album to my youth, and yet there it was, retained better than I thought.
So I'm like smoke in the dawn. We were the young. We were the swarm. Radio Larians, midges and moths.
Do you listen to Andrew Bird at all?
I have. There's some Apocrypha armchair or something, and I have two Andrew Bird, two or three Andrew Bird albums. I'm not a huge fan. I remember he had a moment about 12 years ago where you just couldn't, everyone was talking about what a great whistler he was and every goddamn thing. And I enjoyed him, but I never was as sold out on his stuff as other people.
Yeah, I never heard of him, and 2 or 3 years ago, Pop Market had like a 5 LP set of his, and it did not, I did not buy it, but I thought, well, who's Andrew Bird? And I think I ended up getting one album that was okay. So anyway, by the time this comes out, a month and a half ago, Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, kind of opening their season in September, featured Bird with an orchestra.
Did he sing or whistle?
Well, he did a lot of stuff. So it was a weird thing where he was the first set, he was with the orchestra, and apparently his musical buddy, a pianist, had arranged some of his best known songs, which I did not know, with orchestral accompaniment. And then the second half he came out, and it was largely a solo show, though his pianist friend came out and accompanied him for a couple songs. But he had a
Yes.
violin, he'd play it into loops. And occasionally he'd play guitar, and I hate the way he plays. It's just very inexpressive. I don't know. He's terrible on guitar. And he'd whistle, and he sang, and he'd loop himself, and occasionally there'd be some piano. Yeah, I guess my take on him, having been exposed to him for a good 90 minutes to 2 hours, is okay. As Joy said, didn't turn my world upside down. I was like, yeah. So I thought it'd be kind of, it was a crossover thing, but it wasn't. I don't know. The symphony orchestra plays the greatest hits of REO Speedwagon or something, which is, when they pander, they really
Right.
pander. They get right down in the gutter. But it was exhausting. By the end of it, I had quite enough, and it was pretty full crowd, mostly 30s and 20 somethings, very enthusiastic. There's a real loud groupie far to our right, who kept explaining how much she loved him and the rest of us loved him, and a very loud, piercing voice. And it was this weird feeling of, I think it's a generational thing. I mean, one odd thing was like, well, I'm not too comfortable about this with the orchestra. We'll see how this goes. And at some point, I'm like, dude, you've got 100 trained musicians playing your music. Just don't, I don't know. Maybe it's a generational gap. I'm like, this is a fucking weird attitude to bring to this, Because in a way, it was like, I don't know. It seemed like ultimately it was a humble brag to me.
Right.
And I'm like, look, these guys have got some better things to do, like playing fucking Brahms or something. So, like, I don't know. If you're not excited about it, don't fucking do it, but don't tell us while we're sitting in the seat that you aren't all that excited about it, but you are doing it. We paid for it. It seemed like an odd attitude. So I don't know. It was his songwriting range doesn't seem to be infinite. And I know a lot of people were caught up in these kind of, pop moments, but as an outsider, I don't know. I again, not that he was incompetent. He's a fine singer. He's a great whistler. He both plays the violin very well, and he'll strum it like a little tiny
Yeah.
guitar, and that works. When he plays guitar itself, and he didn't do that very often. God, I don't know. It was weird. I don't know. Normally, I have no feelings about a guitarist or whatever, but there it just seemed. I just didn't like it. It was like very mechanical and just inexpressive. And as a singer, he swoops around, but he lacks, for me, the last degree of expressiveness. I mean, he sings, he's fairly expressive in the sense of moving his voice around and doing various effects and swooping up and down the scale and whatever, but he's not somebody who necessarily touches me. So anyway, it was just an interesting event. I've now gotten a good solid dose of Andrew Bird, and I think it'll last a lifetime. anyway, I was eager to hear the symphony after a long summer off. So I signed up for it. And there he was.
Well, I, you know, like my reaction to him is I don't, you know, I remember the violin playing. I remember the strumming. I don't remember his singing being particularly meaningful. But as someone who whistles and who will whistle along with solos on jazz albums, you know, or whistle my own solos over jazz albums, he's a fucking god. That man can, I think of myself as a good whistler, and then I remember hearing him, and I'm like, oh shit, I should just stop doing this. You know, because he is otherworldly. He is really talented at that.
But it's weird because, you know, I was explaining to people at work, it's like, why, you know, and he's a really good whistler, and let's give you
right,
a look.
Like, really?
Like, and it's like, you don't understand. It's like, well, but not, he's not saying, you know, hoo-hoo, come over here, baby. I mean, it's just kind of hard. I think for a lot of people, they don't even get how difficult what he's doing is, or even know what it would be to be a good whistler. I never heard an example of someone who's like, but he is. Yeah, he's a fucking good whistler.
My first, it happened when I was very young. I remember hearing, I can't remember where, I was like a kid, like 4 or 5. And I remember hearing a recording that I've only come to own as an adult of Bing Crosby singing in the cool of the night, or in the cool of the day, in the green of the day, when the blue of the day meets where the gold of the day meets the blue of the night. Fuck, there it is. When the gold of the day meets the blue of the night, and he whistles. And I remember as a kid learning that solo, like learning to whistle that, you know, and Bing Crosby was a very expressive, very good whistler. And my dad used to whistle a lot, and I learned how to, so there's a kind of a, it's not really circular breathing, but you can whistle breathing in if you know what you're doing. So you actually, you know, you can have long passages, you know, because if typically, at least for me, whistling a note, breathing in, it's a much narrower range. So I have to be, can't be at a high or a low point, you know, to inhale as I make a sound that's tolerable. And Bird can do all of that. Like, and he has an extraordinary range as a whistler and great control, lots of tremolo. Like, he just knows exactly what he's doing. He's a fucking god. Sounds stupid. You know, he's a god at whistling, but he really is.
Yeah. But I personally would not recommend spending 2 hours with just his music. I think of him as like he'd be an ideal guest star on an album. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and Andrew Bird's on a track and like, cool.
Andrew Bird and Bobby McFerrin do a duetto.
No. Okay. Let's stop right there. That is the end of Pop Matters. Thank you for tuning in. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 152. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you like, send me a message on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, or if you prefer, you can stream it at All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we discuss works by Steve Kuhn, Andrew Lamb Trio, Paul Austerlitz, and Paul Anka. Till next time, take care.